This is an RNZ podcast.
This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. There was a sudden surge of interest in Christianity and politics this week, with the possibility of new political parties firing up our political reporters.
Makes me feel very excited, this idea of this launch of this political party.
Is he national saviour?
Well, who knows? The leaders of Christian parties have been bits of oddballs until now.
Meanwhile, the Prime Minister met the world's top Mormon here this week, and it made heaps of headlines. In Utah, but not here. Also this week, we look at why the Pike River families didn't want the media along for the ride when they were finally able to enter the mine nearly 9 years after disaster struck. But before that, it named no names, but the much-anticipated report into bullying in Parliament did lift the lid on what's turned the place toxic. And journalists there are part of the problem, according to the report. But there wasn't a lot about that in the media.
There are so many quotable quotes in this report. The thing is that the reviewer, Debbie Francis, she interviewed 200 people anonymously, and anything they said to her, of course, now is destroyed, so they'll never be identified, the people that spoke to her and gave these quotes.
That was News Talk ZB's Barry Soper last Tuesday talking about the just-released report into bullying and harassment at Parliament. And it certainly was full of quotable testimonies, albeit all anonymous ones, such as this one.
There's the few who are various shades of shits. Everyone knows who they are, and no one ever challenges them.
But Barry Soper wasn't at all impressed with some of those personal accounts in the report.
And they said that another one, an MP, liked to touch the arm of any woman he was talking to.
See, that's silly.
Which was unpleasant. Well, I don't know why it was really included, because to me it sort of demeans the report. I mean, don't put the silly stuff in.
However, the report made it clear some respondents had alleged serious sexual assaults had taken place at Parliament. Its author Debbie Francis referred to three serious incidents, and just how serious was the lead story on Wednesday's morning report for RNZ News.
Parliament Speaker says he believes people have been raped at Parliament during the past 4.5 years. A report released yesterday has revealed frequent bullying, harassment and intimidation involving staff, MPs, media and members of the public.
1 hour earlier on Morning Report, presenter Susie Ferguson had asked the Deputy Speaker, Anne Tolley, what she knew.
I have to say it's not surprising when you look at some of the work that I've been doing with the International Parliamentary Union, with other parliaments around Europe.
Is it not quite shocking that we can be openly acknowledging this, though?
Yep, it is shocking that staff are clearly aware of this.
So there are people going to work this morning. There will be people already at work on Parliament grounds. And amongst them is walking a sexual predator.
A predator.
So did political reporters also find it shocking, but not surprising, like Anne Tolley there? A question we'll ask in a minute. But on Wednesday afternoon, the story took a new turn. Trevor Mallard fronted reporters in Parliament to say that one parliamentary staffer had been stood down after a historic allegation of sexual assault. And the frustration of News Talk ZB's Barry Soper at the limited information was apparent as his press conference wound up.
So that's one of the people that anonymously gave...
Barry, how can I answer that question?
Well, because you have confusion, that's
why. No, well, I can't be responsible for your confusion. Sorry. Thank you.
But one of the reasons that all this was out in the public now in the first place was that the media had pursued bullying stories in the past. Speaker Trevor Mallard launched the inquiry last year, prompted by revelations in the media. The New Zealand Herald had revealed that National MP Maggie Barry had been investigated after complaints of bullying from her staff, and she was confronted about that in the corridors of power, about allegations going all the way back to her time on a TV gardening show.
Did you call public servants hired help?
I don't recall that at all.
That you may have?
No.
Meka Whaitere was stood down as a minister over alleged hands-on harassment of a staffer, and MP Jamie Lee Ross was also accused of bullying some of his staff. And since then, Stuff's Andrea Vance reported that almost 40 back-office staff had left Parliament since last Christmas, and some of those had signed non-disclosure agreements on leaving their roles at Parliament. Now, the secrecy and the anonymity has been a big concern for the news media. In an editorial last year, the New Zealand Herald complained that Parliament's inquiry would not be publishing particular incidents or names. But when the report was released last Tuesday, the report said there were a small number of MPs widely known to be serial offenders, but who are protected by the system. So how then did the news media respond to that? Well, on the Project show on 3 last Tuesday, NewsHub correspondent Patrick Gower, who was formerly NewsHub's political editor, revisited a notorious case of Trevor Mallard trading punches with another MP in Parliament many years ago.
Yeah, let's get the goss. Joining us, please welcome former MP Tohenare.
Hey, kia ora, Toh, thanks for coming. And, you know, this report's not just about what we saw there, the stuff in Parliament, but it's about the stuff behind closed doors that goes on between MPs and their staff. I mean, lift the lid on it for us. What's it really like?
Oh, there's a handful of, excuse me, cockwombles that walk around the place thinking that they own the place. And it's only a handful.
None of the four presenters on the panel on the project raised the role reporters might have played in turning the place toxic. But the report did, explicitly and upfront, in this introduction.
Some readers of this report may be expecting a story in which bullying and harassment are mostly undertaken by MPs. But bullying and harassment is also alleged by respondents from managers to staff, among MPs, from the public to staff and MPs, and from members of the press gallery.
The report went on to say that press gallery journalists are employees of media agencies and, as such, largely out of scope of that review. But they weren't out of scope of the people who told the review what they'd seen in and around Parliament. For example,
a significant number of respondents, not all of them MPs, commented on what they perceived as inappropriate behaviour by members of the press gallery or media more generally.
Some felt that journalists in Parliament sometimes
cross the line into disrespect in pursuit of clickbait. Their behaviour can further fuel the overall environment of gossip and intrigue.
And another comment, which the report said was in tune with several others, said this.
Gallery behaviour is unacceptable. They come in there perfectly nice people and then adopt this persona of the classic bully. You can watch it happen.
The report also noted that press gallery reporters enjoy considerable physical access to MPs and ministers in the corridors of power, meaning they can confront them in the hallways. As we heard earlier, Maggie Barry had reporters in her face about those bullying claims when she was moving from place to place in Parliament. And another minister on the receiving end of this sort of thing from time to time, Broadcasting Minister Chris Farfoy. 10 years ago, he was a press gallery reporter for TVNZ in Parliament, getting in the faces of MPs. And in the case of New Zealand First's Brian Connell back in 2008, in the gent's toilet too.
Can you confirm whether or not you're taking your wife on this trip?
Piss off.
Back in 2012, NewsHub's Duncan Garner quit the press gallery, and last year, he told the AM show's viewers this.
I was 38. I'd worked in Parliament for 17 years. I'd become like them. Mean, combative, cynical, and I drank too much. I had to get out.
And this week, on the same show, Duncan Garner said, like other pundits, that the parliamentary report into harassment and bullying didn't surprise him.
Totally confirms the sham or the club or the bubble that MPs work in, where they take no blame, they use their power to intimidate and control, and when it goes belly up, they use taxpayers' money, hush money, to send staff on their way.
But is Parliament's press gallery a bubble within that bubble that Duncan Garner was talking about there? In the many responses to the Francis report that our political reporters have written and aired, none have addressed the claims in it that the media are a part of Parliament's problem culture. So this week, Media Watch asked the chair of the Parliamentary Press Gallery, Stacey Kirk from Stuff, if they accepted the things that some of the parliamentary people had said about their conduct in that report. She and the deputy chair, Sam Sachdeva of Newsroom, gave us this statement on behalf of the Parliamentary Press Gallery.
It's fair to say there are parts of the Francis report which come as no surprise, such as the high-intensity culture and long hours at Parliament. However, I don't think any of us were quite aware of the scale of the problems or the culture of silence that has developed over the years.
The statement says that one of the reasons for that is the use of hush money and non-disclosure agreements, and it points out that the parliamentary service which runs the place isn't subject to the Official Information Act. But how does the Parliamentary Press Gallery respond to assertions in the report that political reporters there are part of Parliament's problem, and that some of them turn into bullies once they start working there?
Without specific examples of the alleged behaviour, it is difficult to respond in detail. However, there are often robust exchanges between the media and politicians, press secretaries or other political staff, which you would expect when we are trying to uncover the truth on behalf of New Zealanders and they disagree with our interpretation of a story.
The statement says, "We are happy to respond to the allegations made against the press gallery and work with the Speaker on the proposed code of conduct for Parliament while safeguarding the independence of the media." So it remains to be seen if the culture of Parliament and the political reporters who work there really does change as a result of this report. And you can read the full statement from the Parliamentary Press Gallery in the online version of the story. Just go to the Media Watch page of the RNZ website, rnz.co.nz, or the Media Watch section on the RNZ app. Nearly 9 years have passed now since disaster struck at the Pike River mine and 29 miners were killed. And this week, their family members were able to go inside the mine for the first time, a real milestone for them in a long and sad story. And as Jeremy Rose now reports, the media attention that's come with that hasn't always been welcome.
Tears and cheers greeted the successful first step back into the Pike River mine today. A highly emotional time for family members who have waited 9 years for re-entry into the mine where 29 of their loved ones were killed.
That was how TVNZ began its 6pm bulletin on Tuesday night. It was a truly historic event. But as Lisa Davies' report went on to note, there was no media there to record it.
What a momentous day this has been in the push to re-enter Pike River Mine. Finally, they are back in. The families wanted today to be private, but when we met them at the mine gate after the ceremony, they were elated. They were smiling, they were even laughing, and they were holding close pieces of the shattered concrete seal. It represents to them just how far they've come.
Media had to make do with footage supplied by the Pike River Recovery Agency.
This is the moment many of the Pike River families dreamed of. A loader heading inside the portal, bringing out a block of concrete that once sealed the mine.
News Hub's Thomas Mead incorporating some of the footage into his report. So why did the families ask the media to be excluded from the mine opening? Well, that's a question TVNZ's breakfast host John Campbell put to Anna Osborne, a spokesperson for the families and a tireless campaigner for the reopening of the mine that morning.
Most of the families who attended the event on the 3rd, we were accepting of media being up there and they treated all the families very well too, I might add. But, you know, it is quite invasive when we have some really private families that don't like being in the media spotlight. And, you know, I don't like it either, but that is part of who I am to get to where we are. So today families did say that they would really just like a private, quiet time so that they can reflect with the families by themselves just for a couple of hours. You know, there will still be footage taken up there and it will be shared later on to all media, but just for a couple of hours, the families just want a bit of them time.
And as Lisa Owen reported that night, the exclusion of the media from the mine meant news of their successful re-entry was first revealed on social media.
The news when it came was brief and to the point, a simple tweet from the Pike River Recovery Agency saying, "Re-entry has happened."
Later that day, family members of the 29 men did make themselves available for interviews.
Today was a day for the families of the 29 men who went to work at the mine and never came home. Some, including Tracy Kane Harvey, emerged carrying cylinders of the cut concrete seal from 30 metres inside the mine. She held it up like a trophy.
It was very emotional. It was hard them looking back and seeing all the lights, you know, something that we wish we could have seen nearly 9 years ago.
Tracy Kane Harvey speaking to RNZ's Logan Church. On the whole, the media seem to have accepted that the families of the 29 men who died at Pike River have a right to dictate the terms on which they engaged with the media. News Talk ZB's political editor Barry Soper in a New Zealand Herald column did ask whether the media and more particularly the public were being short-changed. He pointed out that,
"If something goes wrong, we'll be the last to know. There will be a camera there under the guidance of the Pike River Recovery Agency, which will be very much in control."
And he said it was frustrating because,
"The only wrong step made by the media in all of this time was when some Australian yobbo questioned the credentials of the cop handling the explosion's immediate aftermath."
Before concluding,
"As frustrating as it might be, the miners' families' wishes have to be respected, and we can only hope that nothing goes wrong today."
But was Barry Soper right to say a single rogue Aussie scribbler was responsible for upsetting the miners' families? Well, not according to an academic paper published by Victoria University professors of law Yvette Tinsley and Nicole Morham. In a paper titled "The Impact of Grief Journalism on Its Subjects: Lessons from the Pike River Mining Disaster," the two professors wrote,
"A large number of journalists would approach people in their homes, both in person and by telephone, sometimes using deception or dirty tricks to gain access. Family members were also approached, followed and or photographed when they went out, and material on them or their deceased loved ones would appear in the media without their knowledge or consent."
The pair spoke to 17 family members of the men killed in the mine disaster who said that the intense media attention made things worse for them and made them feel invaded, scared, overwhelmed, preyed upon and violated. The article includes direct quotes from the family members clearly illustrating that the distress was caused by numerous different reporters and photographers.
"We couldn't even get off our bus. The media were right up against the door of the bus and the police had to come and move people away, and then they only removed them enough for just basically a person to make a tunnel between the bus and the Pike River building in town. All you could see was microphones and cameras. It was the worst experience."
"We just didn't want our picture taken because we were all upset. We were visibly crying. Just private time that was our area and we wanted to be left alone. I've seen my photo in the papers and the television a hell of a lot, which we didn't want. I thought, how did these crooks get that? How did they get that bloody photo? We hadn't been aware of them at all. But when you came home at night, you would see them on telly or something, you know. That's your space and they just zap you."
And?
"You show them any emotion and then the camera's there and guarantee you they'll get a shot. If you're crying, you're grieving, it's a good story. There's a good photo in that. If you're portrayed as just the average everyday person, that won't sell."
"We couldn't let the kids go outside because the media were there asking them questions and taking photos, and we had to protect them."
Some of those spoken to did single out foreign journalists as being particularly insensitive.
"He said, but I'm here to cover the story and, you know, I've got my right to do this and I'm international media. And I said, I don't give two shits who you are. Get off our section."
Yvette Tinsley and Nicole Morham note that some of those interviews had positive things to say about individual journalists.
"She left a note and said, I know where you're coming from because I lost my grandfather in a mine. I actually rang her back and I said, when I feel like talking to you, I'll talk to you. And she said, look, hey, take your time. I'm in no hurry. And that's people that you relate to. They respect how we felt."
Carol Much from Auckland had relatives caught up in the Pike River disaster, and she was in Greymouth as it unfolded in November 2010. 2 years later, she recalled the moment the family members were given the news that the 29 miners must have died.
"People shouted, people screamed, people fell to the ground. The whole meeting just dissolved. And here we are, we just stumbled out of a side door to be caught in the lens of a Reuters camera. I've since looked up the photographer's name and I see that it was one of those 50 best photographs of a certain time. And we didn't know about the photograph until we got home to that particular sister there, and someone phoned up and said, get on stuff now. And here's this raw photograph of exactly how we felt at that moment. And initially we were just shocked. How could they? How dare they? They didn't ask our permission. But what happened after that was we got more phone calls, emails, people saying, I didn't really get it till I saw that photograph."
Carol Much was an education professor in Auckland University at the time, and she kept notes on how the media covered the disaster. In 2012, she told Media Watch about visiting the mine entrance soon after the disaster, on another occasion where families decided they didn't want the media alongside them.
A very poignant moment for me was when the families at Pike River were being taken up to the mine, and the media had been asked to not go to the mine, to stay away. And as the buses drove away from the community centre and I looked out the window, the people there were actually crying. They had tears in their eyes. And for me, sorry, I've almost got a croak in my voice now, but for me it was like, these are not people who are insensitive, who don't care, who just, you know, getting a story to pay the bills. These people have become part of our community and they know the pain that these families are going through and they are there with us.
But Yvette Tinsley and Nicole Morham conclude their paper by saying that the behaviour of journalists made an already extremely difficult situation significantly worse.
On a practical level, this interfered with family members' ability to communicate with one another, to access practical and emotional support, and to engage with their communities. On an emotional level, it undermined their sense of dignity, safety, security, and autonomy at a time of great vulnerability.
The pair are in the process of formulating recommendations for how the media could avoid compounding the grief of those caught up in disasters and whether there's any need for changes in the law or regulations to bring that about.
Jeremy Rose reporting there. And when privacy law experts Yvette Tinsley and Nicole Moreham have completed their work on that, we'll hear from them again on Media Watch about whether they think the media need to change the way they work. Earlier in this program, we heard how one thing exercising News Hub's Duncan Garner on his AM show this past week was the bullying and harassment in the corridors of power. But another thing that was bothering him was a plan that he said National had hatched to boost its chances in the next election.
There's talk they're about to set up a Christian party led by MP, List MP Alfred Naira, who simply drive across town and set up shop in Botany. And he'd win that because National would stand aside. You see, and there we have it. They might, Christian party, what, gets 2%, gets three MPs, and there could possibly be a government. That's how it all works. You see the add-ons.
And Duncan Garner wasn't the only one who reckoned that this freshly proposed Christian party could change the numbers and even change the government. And sitting across the table in his studio that morning was National MP Judith Collins.
Is this the first you've heard of this Christian party idea?
Well, yes. as in quite all of this rumour and speculation.
Now, if all this really was news to Judith Collins, she must have been reading the New Zealand Herald with her eyes closed. The prospect of Alfred Naro forming a Christian political party allied to National occupied the paper's entire front page.
Barry, you've written a great story for the front page of the Herald today about Alfred Naro. Is he National's saviour?
Well, who knows? He could well be.
Now, it feels like we've been here before, quite recently. A blue-green party was floated in February, and it prompted plenty of media discussion and speculation that National would gift this new party a safe seat to help unseat the Labour-led government. The story ran hot at the time, but since then, it's gone very cold. So much so that when it released policy details earlier this month for the first time, none of the media reported on that at all. Now, at the time, there was also the suspicion that the idea had been planted in the media by National, and the suggestion that all this was playing out again this week irritated Barry Soper.
And I heard a political scientist today saying, oh, the National Party plants these stories and then sees how it goes in public. Well, I can tell him that it wasn't planted, the story at all. He may be unaware that journalists actually go around and talk to people and start digging a bit, and that's how these stories come into being.
That political scientist he wouldn't name there was the media-friendly Dr. Bryce Edwards from Victoria University of Wellington. But if he disputed the provenance of the Alfred Naro party story, Bryce Edwards was on exactly the same page as Barry Soper about its possible impact.
We could be looking today at something that ends up having a big impact on next year's general election campaign and the outcome of next year's, or who becomes government.
Yeah.
Because as we know, after 2.5 decades of MMP, you need coalition partners.
And Bryce Edwards also agreed with Barry Soper about Alfred Naro as a viable leader.
And this isn't Brian Tamaki, you know, this isn't Colin Craig even, this is quite a respectable, solid National Party, you know, former Cabinet Minister. Naro is actually, you know, someone that I think National will be able to trust as being, you know, not going a bit crazy.
Now there, Bryce Edwards was also echoing Barry Soper, who said that while Christian parties have come close to getting into Parliament in the past, their leaders have been liabilities.
The leaders of Christian parties have been bits of oddballs until now. When you talk about Christian parties, they are conservatives. Now, Alfred Naro is a conservative.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very level-headed sort of a chap, former pastor, religious pastor. You know, it would be ideal. And what a constituency.
That constituency being the Botany electorate, currently containing many Christian voters and represented by MP gone rogue Jamie Lee Ross, who National desperately wants to unseat. Now, as you heard there, Heather Duplessy-Allen on News Talk ZB agreed with her husband Barry Soper. In her Herald on Sunday column last weekend, she said Alfred Naro was perfect as a leader.
He's already in Parliament as a National MP. He's hardly put a foot wrong in 8 years in the place. He's even had some experience as a minister. What's more, he's a likeable, friendly, good-looking guy. What more could you ask for?
But not putting a foot wrong in 8 years in Parliament is a bit generous. 2 years earlier, almost to the day, Alfred Naro put his foot in it in a big way as the former government's assistant minister of housing, when he appeared to suggest that those who criticise his government might find it hard to get public money in the future. And TVNZ News ran a startling clip of Alfred Naro singling out the Salvation Army.
There's a man called Alan Johnson from the Salvation Army. He told me that he was part of the architect of all the media campaign around homelessness. Alan didn't know about half the things that we were doing.
And those weren't off-the-cuff barbs at a Christian agency that was a core partner in the government's plans for social housing, as TVNZ's Katie Bradford pointed out at the time.
They were part of a presentation to that conference. He had slideshows. He knew what he was talking about.
On RNZ's 9 to Noon the next day, pundit Stephen Mills said it was possibly the first time that a charity had been apparently threatened by a minister via PowerPoint. And on the same show, right-leaning pundit Matthew Hooton was even more blunt.
Oh, I just think he should have been sacked straight away.
For boasting and alleging that he behaves in a way that is against the law.
2 years on, and just one day after being talked up as a safe pair of hands, Alfred Naro was under fire for endorsing a social media post describing abortion as a holocaust. Alfred Naro is also a Christian Zionist, and in a video campaign called I Am a Zionist, he says this.
There is no stronger case than the Jews in proving their connection for over 3,000 years to the ancestral homeland through archaeology, genetic studies, and historical and biblical texts that confirm that Judea and Samaria are their Jewish homelands. I am a Zionist because I am also a Christian, and my faith has me believe in upholding the nation of Israel and the Jews as God's chosen people.
There, Alfred Naro was referring to the territory better known around the world as the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The international community broadly considers Israeli settlements in the West Bank illegal under international law, though Israel disputes this. Alfred Naro was a cabinet minister when New Zealand sponsored a UN Security Council resolution stating Israeli settlements constitute a flagrant violation under international law. Now, he's not the only New Zealand MP that doesn't agree with this part of our foreign policy, but it raises the question that the media didn't much explore when they pondered the prospect of a party led by him becoming part of a new national-led government. What policies might a faith-based party that finds itself with influence over a future government want to put in place or change? On his regular weekly interview on RNZ's Morning Report earlier in the week, National leader Simon Bridges said this.
Actually, what we've just seen in Australia, what ScoMo called the quiet Australians, they're here in New Zealand too. All they really want from a government is a strong economy, good public services, and for us to get out of the way and let them get on with their families. And that's what drives me, not these moral, to use your words, quote, conservative issues.
But what might he concede on issues that are touchstones for conservative Christians, such as abortion and euthanasia? On News Hub Nation this weekend, Alfred Naro said that those were on his radar.
Well, faith is evidence as well. It's the value system that people have. And so when people act out of it, you can't say their faith doesn't have evidence. It's actually the evidence of the values that people have and the way they exercise them.
But faith is belief. It's not scientific evidence.
That's right. And so you and I would say that, for instance, when we say that we show love, care and compassion, right? Well, that's faith that you and I have, right? We believe in each other. We believe in the people around us, that they would act justly, kindly, and caringly.
Now, possibly sensing the same gap in the political market Simon Bridges was talking about, on Thursday, Destiny Church's Brian Tamaki announced a new political party to occupy it too.
This makes me feel very excited, this idea of this launch of this political party. When we were up at Waitangi, I actually interviewed Brian Tamaki on this and said to him, look, are you interested in going into politics yourself? And he said, no, I'm not, and almost said that he wouldn't lower himself to that kind of career.
TVNZ's Jessica Much-Mackay on TVNZ's Breakfast Show on Thursday, fired up by the news of Brian Tamaki going into politics again.
He has a really strong following and he will be a political power. And I think it'll be really interesting to see how it develops this afternoon. So as a political geek, I'm very excited to see how this plays out.
Well, as it turned out, it was Brian Tamaki's wife and business partner Hannah Tamaki heading up the new Coalition New Zealand Party, which they insisted will not just be a Christian outfit. But other pundits, such as religion expert Peter Lynham, told the media the leaders of the Destiny Church would have little influence on voters outside the church's membership. But the pull they had on the news media this week was pretty clear, as all major news outlets flocked to Destiny Church's HQ for the press conference announcing the launch of the new party. And then they broadcast set-piece interviews with the new leader, yielding some startling sound bites, such as this one on RNZ's Checkpoint.
Who is your core supporter? Describe that person to me. Who do you think it is? Tall, who are you going to appeal to?
Dark, handsome, gives good kisses, beautiful to me, treats me like a queen.
So you're talking about the man who supports you the most. Yeah. I'm asking you the people that you think will sign up to your party. Who do you appeal to?
I've got a lot of really good friends.
But while the sudden surge in politics and Christianity got the media excited, the global leader of a Christian church with tens of thousands of Kiwi followers visited New Zealand this week and even met with the Prime Minister without making a single headline here. But there was lots, however, on the Mormon Newsroom's YouTube channel.
In Wellington, New Zealand, the nation's capital, President Russell M. Nelson of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints continued his nine-day Pacific ministry by meeting with Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern.
Speaking on the lawn outside Parliament, 94-year-old Russell Nelson praised Jacinda Ardern.
It's an unlikely scenario, a young mother leading a great nation, a peacemaker, a policymaker, consensus giver. We're very impressed with her. She'll have a great future.
However, Jacinda Ardern's success was bittersweet for the media in Utah, where the Mormon Church is headquartered. And under the headline, "It's Mormonism's loss that New Zealand's dynamic leader couldn't find a home in the faith," the Salt Lake City Tribune newspaper said this.
It's our loss when a woman so smart, so driven, and so absolutely awesome feels there's no place for her in Mormonism. Unfortunately, she's far from alone in her generation in being alienated by the church's relentless emphasis on what it calls the traditional family.
Now, while he was here, President Nelson announced a huge new Mormon temple would be built in Auckland, and he spoke to thousands, including Dame Valerie Adams, who said this to the travelling Mormon media team.
His message tonight really hit home for us. The world today is so hard. If we have someone like the Prophet to help direct us, to guide us, to counsel us, and it's important for us to have that.
While all this was big news in Utah this past week, absolutely none of it made the news here, even at a time when our political correspondents were preoccupied by the part that Christianity might play in our party politics from now on. Well, that's all we have for you in Media Watch this weekend, but we'll be back again at about 10:30 next Wednesday night with Midweek Media Watch, talking to Emil Donovan on The Lately Show. And then we'll be back again at the same time next Sunday for Media Watch here on RNZ National.